Although Bozeman, Montana, where I grew up, had no synagogue, I realized I was fortunate to be surrounded by a Jewish family as I grew up. One of my father's closest colleagues, a man named Zair Eyal, brought his family from Tel Aviv to Bozeman for 2 year-long sabbaticals, one when I was 10 and another when I was 16. Zair, like my dad, worked in agriculture, mainly focusing on wheat disease. They were not a religious family, and I don't remember any religious rituals which they shared with us, but I knew his parents fled Poland after surviving the Holocaust, arriving with the first generation that made Israel a homeland for diaspora Jews. Zair was married to Yona, and they had 2 children, Effie and Tally. Smart, shy kids who I had fun running around with in our big backyard. Inevitably, our parents would call us back for dinner, and we'd pull up to a table piled with delicious dishes Yona was teaching my mom to cook. You can imagine my young palate discovering savory chicken with olives and apricots on couscous, warm hummus and falafel with tahini sauce, baba ganoush, and of course, my family favorite to this day, stuffed grape leaves. Later in life, I did connect with religious Jews who invited me to share in their Friday night Sabbath practice at home, to attend special events at their synagogue, and as with Gina and Matt, to sit under their sukkah hut in the backyard, hung in their irreverent religiosity with fruit and candy bars to sweeten the experience. This beautiful connection to our Jewish siblings continues up to the present, and I'm grateful for congregants like Mark and Naomi, who bring their Jewish backgrounds into the life of St. Lydia's. And I'm grateful for congregants like Liz, whose involvement with CBST gives Lydia, St. Lydia's, by extension, a local synagogue connection. I want to make the case that recalling such affection for Jewish people and for the rich and moving religious life of Judaism helps us to better read this passage from Matthew's Gospel. It is quite possible to read this text as showing Jesus as narrow-minded, parochial, sexist even. For progressive modern Christians, it's tempting to side with the cleverness and persistence of the woman in getting what she wants and reject Jesus' silence and dismissal of her as no more than a dog. 2 points of context first. Matthew's community was primarily Jewish, although with some Gentile members. The question of how these Gentile believers fit was a live question for them, and the text is best read with that in context. Second, Matthew's gospel, because it is concerned with the questions of Jewish identity for followers of Jesus, goes to great lengths to root the story of Jesus in the faith of Israel. Out of these contextual concerns, Matthew significantly reshapes the story as he's received it from Mark's gospel, where it also appears. In Matthew's hands, the story becomes not primarily a story of healing, as it is in Mark, but a story of how Gentiles fit into God's plan of salvation. This is crucial not only for the interpretation I'm offering of this passage, but its implications for how we live wisely now, amidst rising white Christian nationalism and much troubling anti-Semitism. In making this interpretation, I'm following my favorite commentary on Matthew, which is written by a Jesuit scholar named Daniel Harrington, who, though a Jesuit, centers a concern about how Christians engage in anti-Semitic readings of Scripture, and especially of Matthew's Gospel. To read the text well, Harrington says, we need to begin with the Jewish background of this text, the election of Israel as God's chosen people. A powerful passage in Exodus chapter 6, where Moses hears God's response to the people's cries and promises to rescue them from slavery in Egypt, is fundamental. In that section, it ends with this: I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. Yet the act of choosing this people was so that they could be a blessing to all the earth. As Isaiah later put it, God gives Israel the vocation to be a light to the nations. In Isaiah especially, there's a universalism to God's intention for justice and peace for all the world. The expansiveness this welcome in Isaiah offers reverses earlier exclusions of Gentiles more generally, but also particularly those excluded because of gender and sexual identity. All these, God says in Isaiah 56, will have joy in my house of prayer. My house will be called a house of prayer for all peoples. In this light, Matthew tells a story of the encounter between Jesus and the Canaanite woman as a tale of inclusion, of an expansive welcome beyond God's chosen people, the Jews. Jesus' first response to the disciples and the woman is to state in unsurprising terms what his mission is, to seek the lost sheep of Israel. Then in response to her plea for help, Jesus paints a domestic scene, saying basically, one doesn't take the food for the children and instead give it to the family dogs. If you look at the Greek, it's not just generically dogs, but it's a domestic scene of both children and dogs who are a part of a household together. So she responds, affirming this, yet names the fact that the family dogs eventually get food too that falls from the table. She takes his analogy at face value, an analogy that makes her, a Gentile, surprisingly part of God's family, one who will share the meal of God's salvation as well. Those of us in the Christian community who are not Jewish must remember, however, that the God of Jesus is the God of Israel. And in following the way of Jesus, we follow one who was fully a Jew. As Harrington puts it, the roots of Christianity are Jewish. Gentile Christians have been grafted onto the olive tree that is Judaism, as Paul's letter to the Romans puts it. Why does pressing on this rather traditional reading of the text matter? I would argue such a reading of this text is deeply connected to one of the most pressing social justice questions of our time, the fight against the corrosive impact of white Christian nationalism. This growing threat is white supremacy on steroids, and it is deeply anti-Semitic. As I've been doing research this summer on the history of European white supremacy, it has become clear to me that at its core is an ancient Christian heresy called supersessionism, or the replacement of Israel as God's chosen people, instead asserting white Europeans as God's chosen people. This move makes the Jews the original European other and led to the replacement of a brown Jewish Jesus with a white European Christ. The racist views first developed in relationship to the Jews were then extended to mark African and Native American bodies as subhuman, lazy, shiftless, in need of being controlled. In October of 2018, Robert Bauer stormed into the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, motivated by these toxic ideas. Many who stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, were motivated by these toxic ideas. Attacks and threats against Jewish people and institutions in the U.S. rose by almost 36% last year and are at an all-time high since they began tracking. Last winter in February, in response to calls for a national day of hate by such groups, along with threats against local Jewish synagogues reported by the New York Police Department, Liz put out a call for anyone who would to go and stand vigil outside CBST as they gathered for Saturday services. It was a cold February day and we bundled up, Liz and Andy and Debbie and others, perhaps a dozen of us. We made signs that quoted Sharon Kleinbaum, the chief rabbi, who says when faced with anti-Semitism to her congregation, be more Jewish. We greeted hundreds of worshipers with a warm Shabbat Shalom as they arrived. It was moving, to be sure, as many stopped to say a brief thank you, some shaking our hands or asking our names, some taking selfies with us. We were, if you will, the dogs in Jesus' analogy. We knew our place in the family and we gladly took it. We were in the family, yet not the children, not the ones first chosen, but by the wideness of God's mercy grafted onto the tree of life, also finding our place. In finding our place, if you will, a certain kind of healing was available to them and to us. We share the sermon at St. Lydia's, and I invite a silence that we hold together. And then when you hear me ring the bell, you're invited to share stories or experiences of yours sparked by the scripture text or by my reflections on it. We begin in silence.